Okay, over to you, Francis.
Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this 100th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. So, champagne and those little funny sandwiches they serve at parties for everyone. Yeah, it's been quite a journey, 8 years and 4 months to get to this 100th webinar. I just wonder if there's anybody, of course, not all of you are here yet. I'm going over the list. I don't see anybody except BL that was here in the very beginning. I think there are, among those who often come, there are a few, but if you've been with us a while, you know how much has changed over the years. So, anyway, yeah. So, this month, we'll continue with HPB, The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky. And this episode describes HPB's break from her husband. Remember last time she kind of dared her mother that she could get married, and so they held her to it. She ended up marrying this older functionary, and then regretted it immediately. So this episode describes her break with him and her escape at the age of 18 to Constantinople and beyond. I mean, after that was it. She never went home. She was on her own, basically traveling for the rest of her life. So, can we get a reader, please? It's just two readings today.
Okay, I'll start this one. Are they one right after another?
Yeah, and I'll just mention that this is where she lived with her husband, this palace at Sardar. So, go ahead.
All right. I'll read this page, and then Joe, when I'm finished with this page, if you'll read the next one, okay?
Okay.
All right. For the 3 months for the couple. As the people lived together, there was a battle of wills most of the time, with Nikephor demanding his conjugal rights and Helena refusing them. The first 2 months were spent in, okay, I can't say that, Dai Shishag, the land of flowers. The couple was visited by the grandparents, Nadja and Catherine, at the end of August, after which everyone went to Erevan. It was here that Helena spent the last month with her husband, now acting governor of the province, and as such, they lived in the fabulous palace of Sardar, where the former Turkish rulers dwelt. Dominating the landscape at Erevan was the distant Mount Ararat of biblical fame. Accompanied by her guard, the Kurd tribal chief Sahar Ali Bek, who HPB says once saved her life, Helena crossed the Turkish border several times and encircled the mountain on horseback. Relations with Nikephor worsened as the week dragged on, and one day in September, giving her guard the slip, Helena rode back to Tiflis, a hazardous journey for a lone woman on horseback in those troubled times. I went into hiding with my grandmother, she wrote. I swore that I would kill myself if I was forced to return to Blavatsky. Senate learned from HPB that family councils followed, and it was settled that the unmanageable bride should be sent to join her father. He arranged to meet her at Odessa, and she was dispatched in the care of an old manservant and a maid to board at Poti, a port on the Black Sea, a steamer that would take her to her destination.
Thank you, BL.
Over to you, Joe.
And yeah.
Got it. But according to Sinet, her desperate passion for adventure, coupled with apprehensions that her father might endeavor to refasten the broken links of her nuptial bond, so she contrived matters so that she and her escort went on board the Commodore and by a liberal outlay of rubles persuaded the skipper to fall in with her plans. The commodore was bound first to Kursk in the Crimea and then to Taganrog in the Sea of Azov and ultimately to Constantinople. Madame Blavatsky took passage for herself and servants, ostensibly to Kursk. On arriving there, she sent the servants ashore to procure apartments and prepare for her landing the following morning. But in the night, having now shaken herself free of the last restraints that connected her with her past life, she sailed away in the Commodore. The voyage itself seems to have been full of adventures. The harbor police of Taganrog, visiting the Commodore on her arrival, had to be so managed as not to suspect that an extra person was on board. Later on, when the vessel arrived at Constantinople, she had to fly ashore precipitately in a caique with the connivance of the steward to escape the persecutions of the skipper. The nature of the persecutions is not mentioned. At Constantinople, however, she had this good fortune to fall in with a Russian lady of her acquaintance, the Countess Kisilev, with whom she formed a safe intimacy and traveled for a time in Egypt, Greece, and other parts of Eastern Europe. HPB, The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky.
Thank you, Joe.
Yep.
So this is at 18. She's already visiting Egypt, Greece, Turkey, Constantinople. She got off to a roaring start. Okay. So this month we'll continue with what we looked at last time. A footnote in that mentions this book, New Aspects of Life and Religion, which develops the idea that spirit and matter of corresponding opacity and density, in other words, that they were a natural match, tend to coalesce, come together. We then explored various reasons why the soul might, quote, free itself from and quit the body for various reasons, such as insanity, spiritual and physical depravity. And this was followed by the pronouncement that, quote, many are the soulless among us, for the occurrence is found to take place in wicked materialists as well as in persons who advance in holiness and never turn back. The latter referring to initiates who had freed themselves from the lower quaternary. HPB then explores the inherent dual nature, not only of human beings, but also of deity. We'll be considering this duality as it was taught in ancient cultures for the rest of today's webinar. The key to this teaching, you can always apply this, is matter is spirit at its lowest point of manifestation, and spirit is matter at its highest. So, citing both the Chaldeans and the Zoroastrians, she, HPB, states, the Zoroastrians regarded their Amshaspins, who were their seven gods, as dual entities, Ferrowers, applying this duality, an esoteric philosophy at any rate, to all the spiritual and invisible denizens of the numberless worlds in space, which are visible to our eye, suggesting that everything, all beings, visible and invisible, are dual in nature. They have a higher and lower aspect. Then goes on to say the seven cosmocratores of the world pillars mentioned likewise by St. Paul, are double. One set being commissioned to rule the superior worlds, this spiritual and sidereal, and the other to guide and watch over the worlds of matter. She continues to make a case for the widespread belief in the duality of deity by citing Iamblichus, who, quote, makes an evident distinction between the archangels and the archontes, then cites the Roman Catholic belief, for while the archangels are in her teaching divine and holy, their doubles are denounced by her as devils. In the footnote that follows, HBB extends the teachings on the dual nature of deity to the rishis and the prajapatis of Hinduism, then to theosophy. Quote, it also throws additional light on what the secret doctrine teaches with regard to the root and seed manus, the root being the higher form and the seed manus being the material form. And finally, to every human being, quote, not only those progenitors of our mankind, but every human being, we are taught, has its prototype in the spiritual spheres, which prototype is the highest essence of his seventh principle. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. Yeah, and Veronica's doing a little translation for us. The Archontes are literally means Lord, Lords. Okay, to begin this session, we return to the main text after that long footnote, where HBB continues to develop this theme on dualism, particularly of God and man. So if we could get a reader, please.
Yes. Irina, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, sure.
Thank you.
But the word "pirur" is not to be understood in this sense, for it means simply the reverse or the opposite side of some attribute or quality. Thus, when the occultist says that the demon is the lining of God, evil, the reverse of the middle.
Irene,
yes.
could you turn up your mic or get closer
okay,
to it?
Sure.
It's a little bit muted and muffled.
Okay, is it better now?
Little bit.
Oh, okay, sorry about Michael. Do you want me to start again?
That's better, whatever
okay.
You just did.
All right. But
no, you can go on from, you can go on where you stopped. I just, yeah.
Okay. Thus, when the occultist says that the demon is the lining of God, evil, the reverse of the metal, he does not mean two separate actualities, but the two aspects or facets of the same unity. Now the best men living would appear side by side with an archangel, as described in theology. Effiant. Hence, a certain reason to depreciate a lower double immersed far deeper in matter than its original. But there is still little cause to regard them as devils, and this is precisely what the Roman Catholics maintain against all reason and logic. The concluding sentence of this sloka shows how archaic is the belief and the doctrine that man is sevenfold in his constitution. The thread of being which animates man and passes through all his personalities or rebirths on this earth, an allusion to Sudratma, the thread on which moreover all his spirits are strung, is spun from the essence of the threefold, the fourfold, and the fivefold, which contain all the preceding.
Thank you, Irene.
Thank you.
Okay, so first, But the word Ferrauer is not to be understood in this sense, for it means, what sense is that? Let me get some context here. Oh. Ladder reach first stage of the upright. Each manas and rishis become 21 in number. Yeah, I'm not sure what she means here. Not in what she means by this sense. I would have explored that if I had I caught it, but I didn't. Not to be understood in this sense, for it means simply the reverse or the opposite side of some attribute or quality. Thus, when the occultist says that the demon is the lining of God, evil the reverse of the metal, he does not mean two separate actualities, but the two aspects or facets of the same unity. Okay, let's see here. But the phrase, but the word Ferrauer is, yeah, I'm sorry, up here. Yeah, the next phrase tells us why. Quote, for it means simply the reverse or the opposite side of some attribute or quality. So Ferrauer, when I had my little speech function say it, they said Ferrauer, but you could never know for sure, does not mean separate higher and lower entities, but rather one entity slash reality with two faces. HPB thing gives us a metaphor for the universe as a single cloak, with the outside surface representing deity and the lining, the demonic nature, which is the chaos of matter. That's the important part, is this supposed demonic nature is not hellish, it's just simply the chaos of matter. She then shifts the metaphor to a metal with its head and tails, again representing the two facets of one reality. Both these metaphors reveal the coexistence of spirit and matter, each on their own plane, but like monad and personality, not separate beings. Next. Now, the best man living would appear side by side with an archangel, as described in theology, a fiend, hence a certain reason to depreciate a lower double, immersed far deeper in matter than its original or its source. HPB uses an extreme example. The best man living is like a fiend compared to an archangel to underscore the relatively degraded position of life in the lower quaternary compared to the ultimate source of that same life, which is one of the seven great archangels or planetary logoi, who are collectively the monads that make up a person's nature. Thus, ultimately, all incarnated souls are doubles or Ferrauers of the Logoi who sent them forth. Next, but there is still little cause to regard them as devils. And this is precisely what the Roman Catholics maintain against all reason and logic. Indeed, the church tragically mistakes density of form for evil. Just because a double, the physical man, is quote unquote fiendishly dense and dark compared to the archangel, that doesn't make him a moral devil. After all, density is not inherently evil. Next, we move on to the B section, which analyzes the second part of the verse shown here in the left panel, which reads, "The three are linked into one, and it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant, called Saptaparna." HPB's commentary starts with, Quote, the concluding sentence of this shloka shows how archaic is the belief and the doctrine that man is sevenfold in his constitution. You have to remember, archaic just means old. You know, he's not, she's not suggesting that it's out of date, like modern usage of the word sometimes uses. It just means that it's incredibly old. A reminder that these stanzas predate the Vedas, the Puranas, and the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and are thus, at least for this root race, the earliest source of teaching on the septenary nature of man. So I want to remind you all that dialogue is more interesting than monologue. So if you have, if you're confused about anything, or if you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand. Thank you for the immediate response. Yes, Joe.
Way back when, in early 1970, late 1970s, a young man in the at the college where I worked told me about Shiva. That was a big puzzle for me. And subsequently, I went to a Shiva show in Seattle, and I remember seeing the five-sided Shiva. And thinking it was separate. This text says, no, it never was. It's just five, it's all
Attribute.
one. It's all one.
Yeah, that's a fundamental way of looking, especially at Hindu iconography. You know, that if it shows like three faces, or even separate beings in a group, it's invariably showing you the aspects of the single deity involved, right? That you're talking about. And yeah, this is fundamental too. And you know, even many casual Hindus don't understand this esoteric aspect. You know, they divide them up and call them different things, and they, you know, have altars or pray to different aspects. You know, but if you go even to the very next level, you'll see that that you're talking about aspects of a unified consciousness. Yes, Barbara.
Yes. We know in the human journey that some layers of materiality are destroyed or fall away in the process of Kamaloka and going to Devachan. That we don't take apparently the most dross of the materiality. And it seems that at each level there's a ring pass knot of which heavier, denser forces cannot proceed. So I'm wondering how there is a god with a lining of demons.
It's the lining represents the entire picture. You could say the entire process from the lowest to the highest of becoming, which exists at any given time. For instance, in the solar system at this point, you know, on Earth, we're in our fourth globe, fourth round, fourth and fourth chain in a fourth order solar system. So it's very dense. As a result of that, you have the dense physical included in this being, you could say, the being who is in through which we manifest, right? So this Shiva, Vishnu, Brahma Trinity has at this time physical plane parts. And but at a later time, when the entire solar system has there is no activity at that lowest level, then the lower threshold will naturally lift to that. Of course, through the process of becoming, through initiation, we each individually redefine our ring past night as we progress, right? And we, supersede the denser material and the denser subplanes as we progress spiritually. And that's a that's a cell within the body of the logos that we are a part of that is, as a result, also lifting the nature of that logos. So it's the that lining, you could say, it's a peculiar metaphor in some ways. I could see it, let's say it that way, as reversed, that the inner would be the lining would be the essence, and that the visible, the outer garment, would be the physical. But it doesn't really matter. You could look at it either way. So yeah, it's a macrocosmic totality that they're describing here, that includes all aspects of manifestation.
So, is it possible that materiality manifested at the Buddhic level, or even is able to go through ring pass knots where the personality generated materiality cannot?
Well, certainly, you could look at it. There's a number of ways to look at it. For instance, we're constantly shedding coarser matter and bringing on higher atomic matter, or at least that second level of molecular matter that is matter that is much higher. That's a redefinition of our ring pass knot. And the previous ring pass knot is now no longer relevant. You could say that a being, quote unquote, of that previous ring pass knot, such as an animal, cannot pass into the field of expression of the ring pass knot of a human being. But even more subtly, over the course of lifetimes, we redefine our own ring pass knot, literally taking in higher substance for the point in the center of the ring and shedding coarser substance as we pass on the circumference. And then at various initiations, there's a dramatic, you could say, recognition and an almost like a magical anointing of the indweller that allows for a sudden expansion of the ring pass knot, but always with the in addition, there's always a releasing of the matter of the lower matter within the forms of the lower quaternary of the indweller. So there's a, in some ways, it's a gradual shifting punctuated through initiation as we move up. And then there's the big event at the fourth initiation when, through the shattering of the causal body, there's a complete transference from the lower three, lower mind, astral, and physical, to Atma Buddhi Manas, the higher three, in our orientation. Right. Still don't know if I've answered your question, but
Yeah, great answer. Thank you so much.
Irene.
Hi, thank you, Francis. Maybe on part B, I would like to have a clarification on the this rebirth on this earth, an allusion to Sutratma, the thread on which, moreover, all his spirits are strung. Is that not allusion, but this is this the reference to the reincarnations and spirits that are, so to speak, growing in each incarnation, or it's the same spirit that attaining more and more quality, spun from the essence of the threefold, the fourfold, and the fivefold, which contain all the preceding. Can you comment on that? I just want clarity on this. Thank you.
And I do an extensive commentary on those when we come to it. Can you hold off for that?
Absolutely, of course. Thank
Okay.
you.
Yeah. Anyone else? Thank you guys. I appreciate the exchange. Let's see where the heck I am right now. Coding sense shows it, okay. Heck are here. Wait a minute here. Ba, 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 ba. All right, so yeah. All right. So as we move into B, it relates to the second half of the verse. This is a very short commentary, by the way, overall. And then she says the concluding sentence of the sloka shows how archaic is the belief. I read that. Yeah, okay. The thread of being which animates man and passes through all his personalities or rebirths on this earth, an allusion to Sutratma, the thread on which, moreover, all his spirits are strung, is spun from the essence of the threefold, the fourfold, and the fivefold, which contains all the preceding. So let's take this phrase by phrase, and hopefully, Irene, this will answer your question. If not, you can ask again when we're done with this analysis. So first, the thread of being which animates man. This is the Sutratma, which in Sanskrit means the thread soul or thread self, which anchors the life principle in the heart, thereby keeping the physical body alive. It also anchors the mind to the brain in the region of the pineal gland. This is that branch of the Sutratma that allows the indweller to be conscious and aware while inhabiting the lower quaternary. So you have two aspects of the thread. One is soul-based, the other is monadic. The fundamental thread, the life thread, which anchors at the heart, comes direct from the monad. The monadic, the monastic thread is anchored in the soul aspect. Next, and passes through all his personalities or rebirths on this earth. So first, the soul directs the monadic stream of energy or Sutratma onto the mental plane, where it activates the mental unit, which then begins to vibrate at the frequency stored in the mental unit from the last life. The now vibrating mental unit is also conditioned by a specific frequency from the solar angel that includes the mental ray and the karmic limitations for the coming incarnation. That combined specific note acts as a selective magnet that draws mental elemental essence from the general mental environment, thus building an appropriate mental vehicle for the coming incarnation. Using the law of magnetic attraction, the Sutratma then descends and awakens the astral permanent atom, where in a similar way, it attracts emotional matter based on the soul's ray choice for the astral body, as well as taking into account the karmic constraints created in previous lifetimes on astral levels. And finally, the Sutratma reaches the physical etheric subplanes, where, using the vibrational information held in the physical permanent atom, etheric matter is selectively gathered, again based on the soul's choice of ray type for the physical vehicle, as well as the karmic restraints, ever-present karmic restraints connected with physical plane life. The etheric mode is then built, which guides the growth of the embryo in the womb. Okay. Next. The thread on which, moreover, all his quote unquote spirits are strung. So the thread is, of course, the sutrātmā. The spirits, as here used, is not so much a person's actual incarnations, but rather the distilled essence of each vehicle as it expresses itself during each past life, which are held, the information is held in each of the three permanent atoms. So you have here, in this wonderful analogy, you have this graphic of these spirits strung on a thread, and the spirits are the sum total of the essence, the distilled essence of all three vehicles for that particular life, right? Next is spun from the essence of the threefold. So the sutrātmā is made up of the triple thread of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, right? Projected down from the monad, anchored in the heart, made of this triple thread of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, which differentiates the energy of the monad and carries the essence of spirit, love, and active intelligence via the soul to the physical man. Next, the fourfold is the lower quaternary, which in first generation theosophy is made up of Kamarupa, the body of desire or the animal soul, prana, the vital principle of life or life force, the linga sharira, the astral or etheric double, which serves as the model body, and the stula sharira, the dense physical vehicle. In Bailey's terminology, the fourfold is comprised of the lower concrete mind or mental body, the astral or emotional body, the etheric or vital body, and the dense physical vehicle. Lower mind is not included in HPB's lower quaternary because first generation theosophy considered the mind principle to be sacred, even when misused by the personality. It's just a difference in perspective. Obviously, the same reality is being contemplated here. Prana is listed above the astral linga sharira because it is a universal principle that carries the life force to the linga and stula shariras below it. Any thoughts or questions about this way this is laid out? Okay. Okay, finally, and the fivefold, which contains all the preceding. So, my first impulse was to define the fivefold as manas, right? The higher monastic subplanes, as in Manasaputra, right? Which is the human soul. But because HPB ends the sentence with which contains all the preceding, that gives us a couple of other options. It's still, since all comes from the soul, it still could be the fivefold, that is, higher manas, which is the active intelligence principle that demonstrates through the soul, right? As through the its own solar fire nature. Now there, but there's another possible that seems to be verified when we go further into that text, and that's that the fivefold represents the five elements: ether, air, fire, water, and earth. and the senses, sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell, which are associated with these five elements, because together they form the material basis in which the three and the fourfold operate. So you're having a continuation of the downward reality, right? Abhimanas moving into the quaternary and then demonstrating through the elements and the senses. So in this interpretation, this latter interpretation, and I won't claim to know for sure which it is, but it seems to be supported in HPB's next statement. And we'll draw a definite line after we go ahead and read this, if we could get a reader, please.
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Panchasika agreeable, 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 Bhagava Purana is one of the seven Kumaras who go to Sveta Dvipa to worship Vishnu. We shall see further on what connection there is between the celibate and chaste sons of Brahma who refuse to multiply and terrestrial mortals. Meanwhile, it is evident that the man plant, Saptapana, thus refers to the seven principles, and man is compared to the seven-leaved plant of this name, so sacred among Buddhists. The Egyptian allegory in the Book of the Dead already mentioned the hymn that relates to the reward of the soul is as suggestive of our septenary doctrine as it is poetical. The deceased is allotted a piece of land in the field of Anru, wherein the manes, the deified shades of the dead, glean as the harvest they have sown by their actions in life. The corn 7 cubits high, which grows in a territory divided into 14 and 7 portions. This corn is the food on which they live and prosper, or that will kill them. In Amenti, the realm of which the Anru field is a domain. For as said in the hymn, the deceased is either destroyed therein or becomes pure spirit for the eternity. In consequence of the 7 times 77 lives passed or to be passed on earth. The idea of the corn reaped as the fruit of our actions is very graphic.
Thank you, Kirsten. Okay, first, Panchasika, agreeably to Bhagavata Purana 520, 25 to 28, is one of the seven Kumaras who go to Sveta Dvipa to worship Vishnu. So, okay. Panchasika literally means the five crested one. In occultism, he is the enlightened mind that has mastered the lower material nature, which he demonstrates through his control over the five elements and the five senses. And that's the tie to the previous paragraph where we were talking about the fivefold one. So you have this high stage of becoming who has mastered this control, who's gained control over the five elements and the five senses. Now, remembering the four elements is the lower quaternary. The fifth element takes you into the ethers, which are, in this case, the etheric subplanes of the mental plane. So there's a tie in there. As a Kumara, Panchashika is one of the seven prototypes of the reincarnating ego. Shvetadvipa, meaning the White Island, right? Shambhala, Mount Meru, is the sacred imperishable land exoterically associated with the North Pole and Mount Meru, and esoterically associated with the central spiritual sun, the latter being the universal prototype of Shambhala. Vishnu is the universal life that enters matter and holds it together, much like the Sutratma does for each human being, hence the name the Preserver. Panchashika goes to Svetadvipa to worship Vishnu because the mind, Panchashika, has to periodically recharge itself at the source of spirit. Exoterically, this is a religious pilgrimage, but is in actuality an energetic, periodic necessity. Ultimately, the whole story, like many spiritual myths, is an allegory for a yogic process. In this story, Panchashika represents the meditating yogi who is attempting to raise his or her consciousness from the triangle of the Ajna Major, throat, and Ajna centers to the crown center, thus ascending from the stage of mental integration to that of spiritual identification. It's kind of a dense passage that we just passed through. Any questions about this? Clarifications? Next, we shall see further on what connection there is between the celibate and chaste sons of Brahma who refused to multiply. Notice all the quotes around these, right? Meaning that they're you.
Francis, what just happened? I'm not sure. I think we may have lost. Francis, you just really reverberated. Did everybody else hear that, or was it just me?
It happens to Francis sometimes. He will
Okay.
deal with it. Yes.
Testing one, two. Are we back? Yeah, good.
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, my system just decides to switch mics on me from one to another, even though I have the default set. It happens once in a great while, maybe every third webinar it comes in. So sorry about that. If I just suddenly go silent, I haven't fallen into samadhi or lost interest. I've just had this weird automatic switch of my mics. So okay, where are we here? Up. Yeah. Oh gosh. Okay, so we're talking about, let me, think we're here, right? Yes, Joe.
Is there any relationship between breath and ether?
Well,
God, the ether.
the divine breath, which emanates from Brahma as a delivery system for initiating a manifestation. I mean, it literally goes out. Phohat responds and binds spirit to matter in all the those little spheres of entified matter, right? And that is all done on what is called the great breath. So breath is a source aspect when talked about occultly. And through, of course, through use of the breath, and this is a very much needed part of the meditation process, one is able to return along the same path as that divine breath sends creation and into the lower spheres. Anyone else? Good question. All right. Okay. So we shall see further on what connection there is between the celibate and the chaste sons of Brahma who refuse, quote unquote, to multiply and terrestrial mortals. The celibate sons of Brahma are the Kumaras, which means virgin or perpetual youth. The same class of beings as Panchashika in the Hindu tradition, right? In the myth, Brahma commanded these high spirits to populate the earth with human forms. Exoterically, the story goes that they refused, thus forcing the lunar Petries to, which are the lunar elementals, the form aspect, to build humanity, resulting in mindless animal man, because lunar Petries can only build the form aspect, right? Then karmic law eventually forced the so-called rebels, the Kumaras, to incarnate into those mindless bodies to provide the spark of intelligence. But this story is a heavy blind. The truth is that the Kumaras couldn't create humanity's threefold sheaths or the lower quaternary because they are beings of fire and thus lacked the necessary dominance over the denser elements and devic beings needed to build forms in and of the lower quaternary. In fact, if the Kumaras had tried to build physical bodies, they would have burnt them to ash. Next, meanwhile, it is evident that the man plant, Saptaparna, thus refers to the seven principles, and man is compared to the seven-leaved plant of this name, so sacred among the Buddhists. Okay, so like the sacred Ashvata tree, the allegorical Saptaparna has its root in the spiritual realms and its seven leaves, representing the principles of man, on each of the descending planes. Turn on my video here. The Saptaparna is sacred among Buddhists because the Buddha used it to illustrate his sermon on impermanence. By the way, Saptaparna is an actual seven-leaved plant that grows in India in the Himalayas. If you count the leaves, you'll see that's true. Okay, let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the phrase, the seven-leaved plant of this name. Could we get a reader, please? I read this. We read this, didn't we? Okay. Okay. So, first, the Egyptian allegory in the Book of the Dead, already mentioned, the hymn that relates to the reward of the soul, is as suggestive of our septenary doctrine as it is poetical. The deceased is allotted a piece of land in the Anru, wherein the Manas, the deified shades of the dead, glean as the harvest they have sown by their actions in life, the corn 7 cubits high, which grows in a territory divided into 14 and 7 portions. Okay, so the field of Anru is Devachan, right? The plane of mental bliss where the soul reaps the rewards of its past lives. Allotted a piece of land represents the specific vibrational state that the soul has built for itself. Corn represents the fruits of one's actions. Corn that is 7 cubits high represents karmic completion in all seven principles of the human constitution. That's my favorite analogy, Corn that is 7 cubits high. Representing, that the Positive karma has penetrated all seven principles all the way up the human constitution. The term manas or manes usually refers to a person's astral remains or shell, but since HPP here qualifies them as deified manes, it probably refers to an ego who has assimilated the personality, right? Soul-infused personality, as to quote, which grows in a territory divided into 14 and seven portions. In Hindu esoteric cosmogony, there are seven lokas or upper regions and seven talas or lower worlds. Mention of seven and 14 suggests that the initiate has mastered both the seven lokas and the seven talas and is thus a quote master of the two worlds. The Egyptian parallel is found in chapter 149 of the Book of the Dead, where the deceased must traverse 14 distinct regions or mounds called iyats in order to reach a state of perfection. Some of these iyats are beautiful and fertile, corresponding to the lokas, while others are terrifying, filled with fire, serpents, and obstacles, thus corresponding to the talas. Interestingly, in the Egyptian version, is that these are interleaved rather than, going, coming up through all the talas at once and then finally entering the lokas and going that way. They're interspersed, suggesting that there are talas which are act as obstacles or processes necessary to master in order to enter the next loka, which is, I think, a more sophisticated understanding of the 14. Finally, we have this corn is the food on which they live and prosper, or that which will kill them in Amenti, the realm of which the Anru field is a domain. For as said in the hymn, the deceased is either destroyed therein or become pure spirit for the eternity in consequence of the seven times 70 lives passed or to be passed on earth. The idea of the corn reaped as the fruit of our actions is very graphic. So this is all about karma. First, Amenti is a generic Egyptian term for the afterlife, whereas Anru is a specific enclosed section within Amenti that corresponds to Devachan. Every deceased person enters Amenti, but only those who have harvested quote unquote good corn can pass through the gates into the protected domain of Anru. Corn here represents the skandhas or attributes resulting in karma harvested from the previous life. In theosophy, karma is an actual substance, as suggested by the corn. If the life was spiritual, the corn is pure and feeds the ego in Devachan, Anru, allowing it to assimilate the wisdom of that life. If the life was materially oriented or evil, the corn is rotten and the ego cannot digest it, cannot use the experience of that life to raise the vibration of the permanent atoms. So the deceased is either destroyed therein or becomes pure for the eternity is based on the karma accrued and/or dissolved during, quote, seven times 77 lives passed or to be passed on earth, which esoterically refers to humanity's evolution through seven globes, seven rounds, and seven root races. Interestingly, Sanat Kumara's identifying number is 777, which is based on this nomenclature. Any thoughts or questions? Yes, Barbara.
Yes, just going back a little bit, that the Kumaras cannot create out of Fokots. So it seems that the elementals use a substance to create, and that the causal body has patterns and intelligence that guides that creation. So is it that Fohat can energize but doesn't have the patterning or the substance to create?
Fohat itself is just an instrument of creation, right? It doesn't create on its own impetus. For instance, initially Brahma sends Fohat forth in order to bind spirit and matter. It's a third aspect electrical methodology for creating forms. So, the lunar Petries can create the forms using Fohat, and then the Manasaputras, who are those who did quote unquote obey the command, right, to descend into matter, they planted the spark of fire, that higher monastic fire that enables that animal man to progress up through soul consciousness. Whereas the Kumaras built the principles of the higher planes, the etheric level principles from the monadic down through the Buddhic plane. So that's the esoteric understanding of the division, you could say the division of labor. They do not use Fohat as the lower lunar Petries use it, but rather use the higher brothers or forms of Fohat in order to build the bodies of the cosmic etheric principles. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. So, another question is about the corn. Every corn will have karma.
Every corn is karma. Yeah, it's not will have, but it literally is. Corn is your karma, DK tells us karma is substance, which is kind of a mind blower. How can it be substantive? But that's reflected in the Egyptian analogy here, where karma is described as corn.
So corn must also have permanent atoms.
Let me think about that one. Let's see. No, it influences the permanent atoms. So, for instance, if you in a given life, you create good karma, and therefore you increase the quality of the vibration in your causal body. That will, in Egyptian iconography, produce quality or good corn, right? Eventually, that amounts, after the entire process, the return to the monad is accomplished, then that becomes corn that is 7 cubits high. In other words, at every principle, at every level of karmic demonstration, you have created enough good karma that you are able to return to the monad. Does that make
Yes,
sense? Go.
yes. I think that somehow the pearls of the Sutratna have some seem to have some influence on skandhas.
Well, they have them built in. The skandhas of that particular life certainly have an influence on your current skandhas as well. But the final quality of a given pearl, we have this thread is made up of all different colored pearls, right? They're not all lily white, and hopefully they gradually become whiter and whiter pearls to extend the analogy, right? And it's the skandhas influence the following pearl or the following life, because those skandhas are gradually elevated, eventually released, right? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's always good to make sense. Thank you. Appreciate your comments. 7 times 77, yeah. HVB is in this extraordinary level of mastery. Did this research, which, by the way, she didn't have to go out to libraries. The books appeared to her on her own inner vision, where she was able to bring forward the equivalent, the basic teaching, whatever it may be, and see it, how it manifested in each culture. So she could look at how a particular principle, like this idea of the seven principles and this karmic, the way karma works and how the release works. She could look at that in each culture. And so by giving us examples from all these different cultures, she absolutely confirms that it has always been a root belief. It wasn't invented in 1875 by Blavatsky. These are because she was that first ray disciple that brought all this ageless wisdom forward for the new dispensation, right? And she did so by citing these fundamental ideas in all these ancient cultures and how they related. We've been reading that, all through the sacred doctrine, how she verifies these ideas put forward in theosophy through these ancient beliefs of the same principles, right? And that's why she's constantly bringing in the Egyptian or the Japanese, or the Babylonian or the Greek, And for us, it gives us, another way of understanding it. If nothing else, metaphors and analogies for understanding the theosophical concepts. Okay, 70 times 77. Okay, HPB's commentary in verse 3 ends with, "For further details as to Saptaparna and the importance of the number 7 in occultism, as well as in symbology, the readers refer to Part 2, Book 2 on symbolism, sections on Saptaparna, the septenary in the Vedas, etc., etc." So here are the four sections on symbolism and the number 7, including a subsection on Saptaparna from the second book of the Sacred Doctrine. What I'd like to do is just give you a taste. We're not going to get into an analysis of this, but just a taste of the kind of teachings that she includes in this. So this is just a focus in on one aspect of the Saptaparna, which is, if you remember, the man plant, which is an allegory, not an allegory, an analogy for the literal physical plant called Saptaparna. Could we get a reader for this? This is just a sample of the of the sided sections.
And Veronica, can you read that? And she put a comment in here, Francis, that says, I want that kind of a library.
We keep at it, and it will someday appear to you.
Hope so. Doing such hard work.
All right, go ahead.
Saptapadna, such is the name given in occult phraseology to man. It means, as shown elsewhere, a seven-leveled plant, and the name has a great significance in the Buddhist legends. So it had also under the skies in the Greek myths. The Ti or Taf, formed from the figure seven and the Greek letter gamma, was, sea, cross and circle, the symbol of life and of earth internal. Of earthly life, because gamma is the symbol of earth, gear, and of life internal, because the figure seven is the symbol of the same life linked with divine life. The double glyph expressed in geometrical figures being triangle and the square, a triangle and a quaternary, the symbol of the septenary man.
Okay, so we'll leave that for what it is. You can get a sense that this richness continues well into the second volume, right? Before we move on to the next verse, because this is the end of the commentary in this verse, let's take a final look at verse 3. When the one becomes two, the threefold appears. The three are linked into one, and it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant called Saptaparna. So this verse is all about the descent of spirit into the microcosm and the immortal higher principles of a human being. First, when the one becomes two, the threefold appears, describes in this context the genesis of the spiritual triad. It is the microcosmic reflection of the macrocosmic creation described in stanza 3, verse 3. So this is verse 3 of stanza 7, the initial three becoming, the one becoming three was the higher realities. In HPB Theosophy, the one is called the Atman, which expresses itself on the atmic plane. In DK theosophy, the one is the monad, which has its place on the monadic subplane of the cosmic physical plane. Both represent the same indivisible, self-contained, perfect unit of life, the microcosmic father in heaven. This highest true self is a differentiated spark of the solar logos, but also exists in a state of absolute synthetic unity on its own plane. Okay. In its primary state, the monad is isolated, In its primary state, the monad is isolated electric fire, perfect but unexpressed. By projecting its will into the waiting mother substance, the one becomes two. It establishes polarity, the duality of Atma Buddhi, the will in magnetic rapport with the love aspect. Then, to make possible its eventual descent into the lower quaternary, the monad invokes the Lords of Flame to spin its downward emanation into the vortex of higher manas. In this way, the threefold Atma Buddhi manas appears. Next, we have the three are linked into one. So once the higher manas is anchored, the spiritual triad, this isn't about going back up into the one. The spiritual triad itself becomes a unified expression from the perspective of higher manas. It's a unified expression. The will of Atma, the love of Buddhi, and the plan expressing itself through higher manas are expressed simultaneously as one unified spiritual impulse. And finally, it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant called Saptaparna. The thread is a sutratma, which we've been talking about, the silver cord or life thread that drops from the monad through the triad straight into the physical heart, keeping our biological organism alive. A lanu is an accepted disciple. The heart of the man plant or human system is the causal body, the egoic lotus, residing on the third subplane of the mental plane. The man plant references the idea of a plant whose roots are in the monad, whose blossoming heart is the soul, and whose temporary falling leaves are the physical incarnations on earth. Saptaparna represents the seven streams of the soul, of soul energy, that vitalizes a human being's seven chakras. Okay, any thoughts or questions? All righty then. Next up. Yes, Anne Veronica.
The seven streams or the seven chakras, they are equivalent.
The seven streams are apprehended by the seven chakras. And to the microcosm are form their own streams of vitalizing energy, right?
Are we talking about the seven rays?
That certainly is primary to conditioning the seven chakras, right? They are purest at the level of the monad, and then they become conditioned by the principle that they animate as you go through the seven principles. You know, at the level of the soul, you have soul conditioned rays, right? So it's, in other words, the rays as descriptions of the soul energy, which is called simply a soul ray, right? But that's not the pure ray at the level of the Great Bear, you know, and the three super constellations. That's at the level of the soul. So it's you have monadic conditioned rays, which is the ray of pure spirit. Then you have soul conditioned rays, which are soul rays. And then you have personality conditioned rays, and they act very differently, though at the core of them all are the seven pure energies that are the seven rays.
Okay, thank you, Francis.
Yeah. And the relation to the seven chakras is very involved, but you know, just some examples: the head is a function of the first ray, the heart of the second ray, right? The throat of the third ray. The solar plexus is a fifth ray expression. Yeah, so there's, it's not just linear from top to bottom, right? Okay. So how are we doing? Well, we have a little bit of time. Great. So next step, verse 4 of stanza 7. Let's get a reader for this verse.
Ben, can you read that for us, please?
It is the root that never dies, the three-tongued flame of the four wicks. The wicks are the sparks that draw from the three-tongued flame, their upper triad, shot out by the seven, their flame. The beams and sparks of one moon reflected in the running waves of all the rivers of the earth. Bhumi or Prithivi.
So those last two terms are other primeval names for the earth, esoteric names. Okay, so let's take a look at the two footnotes. The first, referencing It is the root that never dies, the three-tongued flame of the four wicks, right? States the three-tongued flame of the four wicks corresponds to the four unities and the three binaries of the Sephirothel tree. See commentary on stanza six. So HPB here suggests that the same occult physics found in this verse also exists in the Sephirothel tree of life. The three binaries are the three horizontal pairs of Sephiroth, Chokhmah, Binah, Chesed, Geburah, and Netzach, Hod. These three pairs represent the active and receptive polarities that generate spiritual energy, which are the microcosmic equivalent of the three-tongued flame, the spiritual triad. So, yeah, we're not going to go deep into this at this point, but it's interesting to look at these. Chokhmah, Bina is the primary logoi of the first and second logoi, the first logoi who sends forth the impulse, or the fire of it's like, from one point of view, you can see it as Brahma. And the Bina is the feminine receptive, which takes that spark and encloses it in form. The means by which this happens is fohat on cosmic levels, right? And then you come to the next grouping, which is a soul level description of the same male and female. All that is good is impulse forward by the soul, which it, again is Gevura is interesting because it also has a very strong karmic element to Gevura, where the restrictions, it's Saturnian in this, in that it puts the emanation from Hesed, or Kesed, I think, into the appropriate form for soul expression. And then finally you have a kind of astral demonstration of you could almost call it astral turbulence, but it's the expansion of the astral realm. And there's a kind of funny reversal here compared to theosophy, which is that Hod represents lower mind, and it's but it holds in terms of the restriction, the column of restriction here, in that it puts a ring press now a ring press ring pass knot around this emanation for Netzah. Together they create a Kama Manas. So that's a thumbnail on these. People study these their whole lives, right? All are a downward expression of this threefold flame. Keter being the completely qualified spirit flame that then divides into masculine and feminine. Okay. The four unities are found on the central axis called the Pillar of Mildness, Keter, Tifereth, Yesod, and Malkuth. The central trunk represents the descent of the energy of the three binaries into objective form, ending in Malkuth, the dense physical earth. These four unities correspond to the four wicks of the lower quaternary that are described in both this and the last verse. Okay, so could we get a reader, please, for this next section?
Yes, Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yeah, this, by the way, this rep this references, this A references, it is the root that never dies, the three-tongued flame of the four wicks. So that's what this commentary is on. Go ahead, Barbara.
A, the three-tongued flame that never dies is the immortal spiritual triad, the Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. The fruition of the latter assimilated by the first two after every terrestrial life. The four wicks that go out and are extinguished are the four lower principles, including the body. And this is in quotes, I am the three-wicked flame, and my wicks are immortal, says the defunct. I enter into the domain of Sikkim, the god whose arm sows the seed of action produced by the disembodied soul, and enter the region of the flames who have destroyed their adversaries. For example, get rid of the sin-creating four wicks. And this is see chapter 1, 7, Book of the Dead, and the Mysteries of the Rostam.
Thank you, Barbara. So first, the three-tongued flame that never dies is the immortal spiritual triad, the Atma, Buddhi, Manas. The fruition of the latter assimilated by the first two after every terrestrial life. So, whereas the physical, astral, and lower mental bodies are built of temporary elemental matter that dissolves after every incarnation, the spiritual triad is built of relatively permanent spiritual substance, which is untouched by the cycle of death and rebirth. The fruition of the latter refers to manas, which by projecting a portion of itself into lower mind acts as the monad's sensory organ in the lower worlds. You know, we have this idea that the monad must know exactly what's going on down here. You know, that's not at all the case. It's strictly the quality of vibration achieved, which is the fruition of the latter. The monad projects up that quality to the higher two aspects of Atma, Buddhi, Manas. So throughout a lifetime, the lower mind suffers, learns, and creates karma, thereby gaining experience. The fruition, or corn, described in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is the next assimilated by the first two after every terrestrial life, refers to the upward transfer to Atma Buddhi of the fruits of an incarnation. When the physical body dies, the soul withdraws. The egoic lotus extracts the fruit of that lifetime, then passes this refined essence upward along the antarkarana into the spiritual triad. Next, the four wicks that go out and are extinguished are the four lower principles, including the body. These are the lower mental, astral, etheric, and physical. Wick is used to indicate the form aspect in contradistinction to the three flames of animating spirit. I am the three-wicked flame, and my wicks are immortal, says the defunct. I enter into the domain of Sekhem, the god whose arm sows the seed of action produced by the disembodied soul. So the three-wicked flame is the unified expression of the monad, whose three wicks, the sheaths of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, right, these are higher wicks compared to the wicks in the lower quaternary, are woven from permanent spiritual substance. Thus they hold the flame eternally. Then HPB again shifts to the Egyptian perspective. to show the universality of this verse. The domain of Sekhem is the higher mental plane, specifically the region where the egoic lotus resides. This realm, this is Sekhem, by the way, this realm represents spiritual power and corresponds to the first aspect and the power of the lords of karma. Sekhmet, shown here at, at the far side of the burning ground, is the fiery lion-headed goddess who wields the form-destroying aspect of the first ray in order to burn away illusion, which is what the burning ground is all about, and enforce karmic law. The seat of action, called fruition in the previous verse, is the harvested wisdom and extracted experience from terrestrial life. Sekhem, in the form of karmic law, takes these seeds, the synthesized essence of the soul's past thoughts, desires, and actions, often called skandhas, and uses them as the geometric blueprint for the next incarnation. And then finally, and I enter the region of the flames who have destroyed their adversaries, that is, got rid of the sin-creating four wicks. And then he gives a reference. So the region of the flames is the realm of Atma-Buddhi-Manas that stands beyond the domain of Sekhem. I was trying to illustrate that with the, I don't show it here, but in the expanded view of this painting, you have the Sphinx, which represents this more macrocosmic level. The flames themselves are, the flames themselves are the adepts, the Chohans, and masters of wisdom. The initiate enters this region by taking the higher initiations and thereby joining the ranks of the hierarchy. I know we're a bit over, I just want to finish this. The adversaries in who have destroyed their adversaries is the integrated personality that rebels against the control of the soul. Soul ray versus personality ray. As a disciple progresses from one initiation to the next, the sum total of all their unredeemed past karma and lower desires gradually coalesces into the dweller on the threshold. The destruction of the dweller takes place through the light of the soul, which through this act permanently subjugates the lower self to the spiritual will. Got rid of the sin creating four wicks is liberation from the lower quaternary. Chapter 1 of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, called the Coming Forth by Day, describes the moment the consciousness of the jiva withdraws from the dense physical body and the etheric web, the first two wicks, and consciously steps onto the inner planes. Chapter 7, called Passing the Serpent Apophis, is a spell specifically designed to overcome the serpent who symbolizes the chaos of matter and the unredeemed lower nature, the Egyptian equivalent of the dweller on the threshold. The Mysteries of Rostan is a typo that should read the Mysteries of Rostow. Rostow is the gateway to the underworld, the threshold between the lower quaternary and the hidden realm of Osiris, the spiritual triad. The Mysteries of Rostow were secret initiatory rites where the candidate was placed in a deep trance, simulating death, in order to consciously experience the shedding of the four wicks by means of an encounter with the adversary, Apophis, the dweller, the snake, followed by the triumphant entry into the region of the flames. Any thoughts or questions? That's going to do it for today. Okay. Dates?
The next Treatise on Cosmic Fire is 22 May.
So just this Friday.
Right. The next Light of the Soul is going to be on 7 June. And then we have the conference.
So there will be no Treatise on Cosmic Fire on the second Friday.
Right, the 12th. The Esoteric Astrology Workshop is on the 12th and 13th of June. And
I thought it was 11th and 12th. 13th, 14th, and then
13th. Oh yeah, 11. I'm sorry, you're right. The 11th and 12th, and then the 13th and 14th is the Seventh Ray Seminar. So, okay, right. And then we have the Secret Doctrine 21 June, and that one on 21 June is going to be at 8:30.
Instead of what? Instead right. of seven.
Instead of seven, right?
Okay, so you know that saying is to make sure you're signed up for the Constant Contact so you get these notices and you can adjust accordingly. And you can always go to the calendar at morifederation.com if you want to look ahead and see what's going on. Let me take a look at the chats here. It's just, yeah, people leaving and thanks. All right. Much love to you all. I'll see you for TCF this coming Friday. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Francis. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, BL.